Palestinian mourners hold a funeral in the occupied West Bank for a 15-year-old boy who was shot by an Israeli soldier on Friday. A prominent rights group says France's decision to shut down a leading anti-Islamophobia group risks further stigmatizing Muslims in the country. And the British Prime Minister and European Commission President are to hold talks after crunch talks between Britain and the EU broke up on Friday without a post-Brexit trade deal. And welcome from Tehran. You tune into World News. I'm Marcia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Palestinians have laid to rest a teenager who was shot by an Israeli soldier on Friday. 15-year-old Ali Abu Aliya was shot during a protest against Israeli settlements in a village near the city of Ramallah. He was taken to a hospital where he later died. The Israeli military has denied using live ammunition. The killing drew reactions from the United Nations Middle East envoy, Nikolai Molodnov. He said he was appalled by the killing. He urged Israel to swiftly and independently investigate what he called the shocking and unacceptable incident. Mona Candiel in occupied Ramallah says Palestinians have pledged not to remain silent on Israel's continued crimes.
The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said it's a war crime and that the Israeli soldiers used the live ammunition in order to kill Palestinians, not to prevent them from taking part in anti-Israeli demonstration. This afternoon, hundreds of Palestinians took part in the funeral procession of Ali Abu Aliya in the village of Al-Mghayyar, where people were chanting anti-Israeli slogans. They were holding the Palestinian flags, and they were saying that they will, of course, not remain silent to the Israeli continued crimes there.
Well, Human Rights Watch has condemned the French government's decision to shut down a leading anti-Islamophobia group, calling the move a threat to basic human rights. An HRW researcher said the action against the group called Collective Against Islamophobia in France risks further stigmatizing Muslims in the country. He criticized Paris for shutting down the organization that raises legitimate concerns about anti-Muslim prejudice. Earlier this week, Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin, in a tweet, announced the dissolution of the group. The government accuses it of engaging in activities that provoke hate and acts of terrorism. CCIF has rejected the allegations, saying it intends to challenge the decree in courts. The dissolution of anti-Islamophobia group is part of a crackdown the French government launched against Muslims after recent terrorist attacks. The country has already deported dozens of Muslims and has inspected dozens of mosques. Political commentator Gerard O'Coleman believes the French government's ban on a leading anti-Islamophobia group is aimed at distracting attention from its failures.
The central issue is, what is the function of this particular act? What is the function of the so-called crackdown that's happening? The function of it is to, I think, foment a hatred or a fear of Islam, which distracts from the origins of the core of the war on terror, the function of the war on terror, which is really about, you know, taking away civil liberties, and it always has been. So the every time the government comes under pressure for antisocial policies, and we're in a period where the economy is about to collapse because of the lockdown measures, now they're pulling out the Islamic card, the notion that we're all threatened by jihadists coming into our streets and so on.
The British Prime Minister and the European Commission President are set to hold talks in an effort to break a stalemate in post-Brexit trade negotiations. Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen are expected to hold a phone call meeting later in the day. On Friday, British and EU negotiators paused trade talks to call in their leaders. They cited what they call significant divergences. There has been little progress between the two sides despite months of talks. The three outstanding issues are fisheries, fair competition, and dispute resolution. Britain left the European Union at the end of January, but remains under EU trading rules. The two sides must reach a deal before the Brexit transition period ends on December the 31st. Let's cross over to Brussels, joined by Jerome Hughes. Jerome, good to see you. Well, fill us in. I mean, they have been talking for a long time, still haven't reached any type of conclusive agreement, and there's nothing but just a few weeks left to December 31st. Tell me where it all stands and what exactly it means if they don't reach an agreement.
That's right, Marcia. Well, you know, we've had a lot of deadlines that have come and gone during this entire process, but I think this weekend and certainly the coming days really shows us that time is running out, and so that if we don't get an agreement in these coming days, I think that's very significant, and there is a likelihood that both sides will go back to World Trade Organization trading terms if they don't get a deal, and there's all sorts of implications. But I think this phone call today between Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen, to all intents and purposes, it's effectively a call, I think, between Boris Johnson and Angela Merkel, because, of course, Germany is the powerhouse in the EU. Ursula von der Leyen and Angela Merkel would be very close as well. And so von der Leyen would be getting certainly her negotiating points from Merkel. But these big issues, I mean, we talk about the various issues. Fishing rights has to be a huge one, because the European Union is insisting that it has to have access to UK fishing waters, but the UK doesn't want that. And so, you know, it's hard to see how they're going to get over this hurdle. There's also the issue of when we talk about state aid, you know, the EU doesn't want the UK being able to give government funding to various firms and so on, which would create unfair competition between the UK and the EU in the event that they do have a trade deal. So there has to be a level playing field in that regard. And then in terms of settling disputes, how are disputes settled? Does it go to the EU Court of Justice or whatever? But in terms of here, what will happen if we don't get a deal? I mean, the UK will fall out of several preferential agreements on a whole range of areas. The UK would fall out of these agreements in terms of security, financial elements, data sharing, and transport agreements as well. The EU side looks set, if there's no deal, to lose one of its biggest trading partners. And also, as we talked about, access to UK fishing waters, that would certainly be out. And also access to the UK's significant security and intelligence services. So there are major complications here. And even if we do get a deal, they're saying that there will be major changes and potentially chaos on the borders initially until things are ironed out, because there's a huge amount of trade goes back and forwards between the EU and the UK. But if we don't have a deal, then the implications are much greater. The economic implications, given that we're going through a major pandemic, you know, we already have a major financial crisis in the EU, and so not having a trade deal with the UK would be very disastrous indeed from an economic point of view.
Indeed. Of course, we're watching that story very closely, Jerome. 26 days left to the end of the year. Let's see if they can get something accomplished in that time period that they couldn't the rest of the year. Thanks so much for being with us out of Brussels, Jerome Hughes. Meanwhile, as the UK remains in the grip of the COVID-19 pandemic, the country's health officials and experts are deeply concerned about the effects of the virus on Britain's minorities. Our UK correspondent Richard Sudan has this report from the British capital, London.
Earlier this year, Health Secretary Matt Hancock confirmed what many believed in saying that the government was concerned about the potential disproportionate impact on BAME communities of COVID. Indeed, BAME health workers working in the health service in the early days of the pandemic were some of the first to lose their lives on the front line treating those who had contracted the disease.
the lethal effects of COVID, resulting in deaths and black and ethnic minority peoples. And that's hugely disproportionate for African descent peoples within that overall black and ethnic minority category. And yet this government has routinely refused to recognise that the consequence of institutionalised racism, enforced poverty, the ethnic pay gap that pushes black and ethnic minority workers into the lowest paid public sector, public facing sector jobs, has resulted in them being overexposed to the vulnerability of COVID.
As well as concerns about structural inequalities impacting COVID, some have also raised concerns about the potential of some medical conditions within BAME communities being impacted by COVID.
There have been papers in the British Medical Journal alerting to the fact that certain blood pressure and diabetes medications do seem to cause, when there is an infection already, it's more likely to escalate into the disastrous lung problems that cause sudden death. So I know that there is a difference between Indigenous and BAME communities in this country as regards those problems.
Irrespective of continued debates over health issues within BAME communities, the impact of COVID on those communities due to existing structural inequality is to many undeniable.
We've seen with Belly Malinga and others here in the United Kingdom, a rail worker who was spat upon who later died of COVID, and the doctors overwhelmingly Asian and African, the nurses overwhelmingly African and Asian that have died as a consequence of COVID, being brutally ignored by this government, who are now suggesting that it's down to black people and Asian people's lifestyles why they are more vulnerable to COVID, rather than the brutal realities of institutionalised racism.
As the effects of COVID continue to grip the nation, many people remain deeply concerned about the devastating impact of COVID on some of the country's most marginalised communities.
Although the debate continues, many medical experts believe that COVID-19 disproportionately affects BAME communities already dealing with inequalities within the health service, leading many to ask the question, what do decision makers intend to do about those inequalities? Richard Sudam, London.
Russia has begun its mass coronavirus vaccination using the homegrown vaccine, Sputnik V. Health officials say they have opened 70 vaccination clinics in the capital, Moscow, the hotspot of infections in the country. The coronavirus task force says the vaccine will be delivered first to groups at risk of becoming infected, including medical workers, teachers, and social workers. The vaccine is administered in two injections, with the second dose expected to be given 21 days after the first. The developers of Sputnik V say it is 95% effective and causes no major side effects. However, the fast process of its development has raised concerns about its safety. Russia has so far registered more than 2.4 million infections, which is the fourth highest in the world. Early, we talked to our Moscow correspondent, Marina Kortanova, about the start of the coronavirus vaccination in Russia.
About 2 million doses of a vaccine had already been manufactured in the country. And according to the president, this gives an opportunity, if not to begin mass inoculation, then at least to roll it out on a large scale. Presently, two domestically developed vaccines have been registered in Russia. The third one is expected to be registered soon. It is planned that mass vaccination in Russia will involve elderly people as well as those with chronic health issues or at risk groups, along with senior citizens, are to be vaccinated.
Well, in the U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has rejected a new bipartisan $908 billion stimulus plan put forward in an effort to break the legislative stalemate as the coronavirus surges throughout the country. The plan aims to address the expiration of key economic programs, including unemployment insurance extension. Wyatt Reed reports from Washington.
For the millions of Americans facing possible eviction and the end of emergency unemployment benefits, it seems for now that little help is on the way, at least from Congress. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that a proposed new COVID-19 relief package, backed by centrist Republicans and Democrats, should serve as an opening bid in negotiations with Republicans. It's a far cry from the $2.2 trillion bill House Democrats approved in October, and economist Dr. Jack Rasmus says Republicans are unlikely to allow this latest measure to pass either.
We have a centrist coalition here of Democrats and Republicans in the Senate trying to break that roadblock that Mitch McConnell and Trump represent. And it's sort of a compromise between where the Democrats were and where, Mitch McConnell and Trump are. I don't think it's going to go very far because McConnell's made it clear just yesterday or today that he's not going to offer more than $500 billion. He doesn't care.
With Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin promising to block his replacement, Janet Yellen, from disbursing $455 billion in unspent CARES Act funds, the $500 billion package Republicans are offering would likely consist almost entirely of money Congress already allocated to COVID-19 relief. In the meantime, tens of millions of Americans face the looming threat of eviction as a CDC moratorium expires this month, and over 12 million are set to lose unemployment benefits the day after Christmas. Hunger is rampant, and it's expected that over 50 million people will suffer from food insecurity by the year's end. With so many facing increasingly dire circumstances, authorities in some states are working to bridge the gap in benefits on their own. Legislators in Michigan, Colorado, and Minnesota are currently eyeing measures to make sure that happens if Congress doesn't step in. But according to Dr. Rasmus, that may be easier said than done.
State and local governments, in this $908 billion, I think $180 billion was proposed, state and local governments that are going broke and are laying off workers by the hundreds of thousands now because they have no revenue at a critical time when they've got to be involved with distributing, the vaccines. So state and local governments are really in a desperate situation.
The desperation doesn't end there. The slow-motion tsunami of unemployment and homelessness is already starting to occur in cities all over the country. But for now, there's little many Americans can do but pray that help arrives in time. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
Meanwhile, the United States has terminated five cultural exchange programs with China as tensions grow between the two countries. The State Department said the programs in question are fully funded and operated by the Chinese government, dismissing them as, quote, soft power propaganda tools. Washington and Beijing have been embroiled in the dispute over a range of issues, including trade, Hong Kong, security, and the coronavirus pandemic in recent years. Tensions escalated further after the U.S. government blacklisted several Chinese firms, a move condemned by Beijing. The Chinese government has time and again accused the White House of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in Hong Kong and Taiwan affairs, as well as in the South China Sea. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has slammed the U.S. sanctions against his country, adding that they have taken away 99% of the Latin American country's income in dollars every year. Maduro asked Venezuelans to elect socialist deputies in the upcoming parliamentary elections so that his party can better fight U.S. measures against his country. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Tens of millions of Americans are paying precious little attention to the Chirpy Taylor Wall Street sticker. The simple reason, they own no stocks at all. Millions of other Americans who do own stocks don't see any reason to celebrate either. They're finding themselves forced, amid pandemic economic collapse, to start selling the stocks that make up the bulk of their retirement savings. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Sam Pizzigatti, writer. This article is published under the heading, Why the Rich Cheer Wall Street Records, Americans Are Draining 401ks. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The all-time record highs that Wall Street had registered last week have given some Americans, the nation's already rich, considerable cause for celebration. And the rest of the nation, tens of millions of Americans are paying precious little attention to the Chirpy Taylor Wall Street ticker. The simple reason, they own no stocks at all. Millions of other Americans who do own stocks don't see any reason to celebrate either. They're finding themselves forced, amid pandemic economic collapse, to start selling the stocks that make up the bulk of their retirement savings. How best to start understanding this story? The best place to begin, the latest numbers on stock ownership from the Federal Reserve. Fed researchers have been tracking who exactly owns the stocks that trade every business day on Wall Street ever since 1989. Back nearly 30 years ago, in 1992, the share of stock nationally that belongs to America's poorest half of households hit an all-time high. That high amounted to all of a minuscule 1.6%. How much of America's stock wealth does the bottom 50% hold these days? At the end of this past June, the most recent Federal Reserve data point available, the nation's poorest half held less than 1% of the nation's stock holdings, just 0.6%. The nation's poorest 90% all combined now hold just 11.8% of the nation's stocks. Numbers like these help explain why massive numbers of Americans didn't rush out onto the streets to cheer earlier this week when the two top Wall Street benchmarks, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and S&P 500, hit their own all-time record summits. Shares of stock, either held directly or through mutual funds, make up just 2.3% of the total assets of households in the bottom 50%, and a mere 7.6% of the assets the rest of the bottom 90% hold. America's richest 1%, on the other hand, have plenty of reason to celebrate Wall Street records. Stock holdings make up over 40% of top 1% household wealth. These 1%ers overall hold 52.4% of the nation's stock, a share almost five times greater than all the stock that households in the bottom 90% hold. This top 1% share has been steadily increasing. Since 1989, the year the Fed started keeping track, the top 1% share of the nation's stock holdings has jumped 22%. The bottom 90% share has dropped 33%. What does that mean in actual dollar terms for average American households? Fed research conducted last year found that 55.8% of the households in the middle 20% of U.S. income earners hold the stocks. The median most typical value of these stocks for those average Americans who hold them just $15,000, down $1,000 from 3 years earlier. And that value is shrinking this year as increasing numbers of Americans start taking advantage of changes the U.S. Congress made this past spring via the COVID-19 relief legislation that let economically reeling Americans under age 59 1-second withdraw dollars out of their 401k, IRA, and other retirement accounts without having to take the standard 10% early withdrawal penalty. The COVID-19 calamity, notes Denver CPA Celeste Chimenti, has forced many Americans to exhaust their savings and emergency funds, and that's left them agonizing over whether they will need to dip into retirement savings to cover current expenses. But dipping into retirement accounts, selling the stocks in these funds, can have a devastating impact on future retirement security. Withdrawing $10,000 from a 401k today can cost a 35-year-old $100,000 by the time retirement comes around. The rules around 401ks and other retirement accounts have traditionally used penalty fees to discourage cashing out account holdings. In COVID-19 America, with withdrawal penalty fees now off the table for this calendar year, Americans have begun making those withdrawals anyway. The nation's largest 401k provider, Fidelity Investments, reports that 5.2% of its clients made withdrawals from the start of April through October. Vanguard, another major provider, says the COVID crisis had 4.5% of those eligible making withdrawals. T. Rowe Price computes a 7% 401k rating rate. Some analysts are claiming that numbers like these present no real cause for concern. Americans undeterred by the COVID-19 economic downturn, writes Ted Gottbout for the National Association of Retirement Plan Advisors, have overwhelmingly continued saving for retirement. But the trend lines are going the wrong way. The number of Americans cashing out the stock they hold in their retirement accounts are rising as the income support for average Americans provided through the CARES Act expires. Through May, for instance, fewer than 2% of Vanguard 401k holders were withdrawing funds. By the end of the summer, that rate had more than doubled. By the end of the year, the Employee Benefit Research Institute's Lori Lucas estimates 10% of Americans with 401ks could be raiding their retirement futures. And those who need COVID economic relief the most, gig and other low-income workers who've lost jobs or hours to the pandemic, don't have retirement accounts to withdraw from. Overall, the Economic Policies Institute reported last year nearly half of working-age families have nothing saved in retirement accounts. On Wall Street, that reality still doesn't particularly matter. Let the good times keep rolling.
This is This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life here on IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi. In this program, dear brothers and sisters, I would be talking about arrogance. Knowledge, like property and social status, brings about arrogance. And there is an important point that is necessary for us to tell ourselves as religious students or university students, and that is the danger that will ruin all our efforts if not understood properly. And that is the danger which is called arrogance or ghurur. And the person who has arrogance is called maghrur. This danger is found in every group of people, in all the segments of the society. And we talked in previous programs about threats. One of them was envy, which we talked about. The other threat is arrogance. These are the two threats that, according to our narrations, the scholars face the most. And if you don't deal with it early, then you would have huge issues in the future. And God forbid, you can also lead a whole community in the wrong path. The knowledge that one has in any field can cause arrogance, dear brothers and sisters. Do not let this arrogance penetrate your being. Arrogance destroys people, just like it destroyed Iblis, Satan, the devil, when he refused to prostrate in front of Adam alayhi salam. Why? Because he said, you have created me from fire, and you created Adam from dust, mud, sand. This, I am better than him, caused him to fall. There is a tradition that says that the first sin on earth was Iblis' arrogance. He fell due to his arrogance to a place where everyone curses him. One is arrogant when he imagines himself to be of importance or imagines that he has special characteristics. For example, in North America, we see until this date racism, where you have police brutality killing innocent black youth or black people in the States. And you see this over and over again. And it has always existed, from the lynchings of the 19th century to putting them on stakes, putting fire on them, and to the lynchings of the 60s and 70s and the police brutality in the 80s and the 90s until this date. You see that some people see themselves far better than others just because of the color of the skin. You see the same racism in some European countries. You see racism in the Muslim Ummah, where you see that some think that they are better because of the color of the skin against their own brothers, their own brethren in the deen. And you see this over and over again.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, 'cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for me. is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
In the heart of Islam, Mecca and Medina, even there you see racism against the pilgrims who come from all the different corners of the globe for the pilgrimage. And you see that some people who are citizens of that country treat them very, very bad because they are from certain undeveloped countries. Arrogance, dear brothers and sisters. Arrogance will lead us to hellfire. So one is arrogant when he imagines himself or herself to be of importance, or imagines that he has special characteristics. He thinks that he does not have any needs. He considers himself important because he has learned, for example, some technical terms, or he considers himself someone who does not have any needs because he has become rich and wealthy. Someone is more likely to become arrogant if his social status increases after he has gained knowledge, wealth, or a political status. When one becomes, for example, a president or a minister or an ambassador or a CEO of a company, and he sees greatness in himself, and that may lead to arrogance. So be aware. We should all be aware, dear brothers and sisters, when we feel that, is this arrogance? What I'm doing now, or how I'm treating this worker, or how I'm treating this shop owner, is this arrogance? Am I seeing myself higher in status because I come from this country and he and she comes from another undeveloped country or not? We should ask ourselves this over and over again. Once upon a time, this arrogance led a whole nation. The nation I'm talking about is the United States of America, to have separate toilets for the colored people and the non-colored people. Separate seats in the buses and the trains. Separate water fountains where you could drink for colored and non-colored. The same goes for South Africa and the apartheid regime, where you saw that people with color could not be in the VIP section of a train. And actually, Mahatma Gandhi was one of those people who was thrown out from the train, even though he had the train ticket. He was thrown out because he was colored. Arrogance, dear brothers and sisters, and ignorance will lead us all to hell if we are not aware. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you, and try to implement this in our daily life. Try to implement these techniques and these feelings whenever we feel it. Try to implement it in our daily lives. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh,
all I need to be all so I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the coronavirus pandemic rages across the globe, much of the focus centers on the growing human death toll, which has climbed above 1 million. But experts caution that a handful of our closest living relatives in the animal kingdom are also in jeopardy from SARS-CoV-2 virus, the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19. Stay with us for an article penned by Paul Nicholas, a commentator and writer, under the heading, Endangered Primates Face High Risk of Catching COVID-19. Stay with us for more of Paul Nicholas's article. Recent analysis of more than 400 vertebrate species, including birds, fish, amphibians, reptiles, and mammals, predicts that critically endangered primate species such as the northern white-cheeked gibbon, the Sumatran orangutan, and the western lowland gorilla, as well as the endangered chimpanzee and bonobo, are particularly vulnerable to infection due to their genetic similarities to humans. Study leader Harris Lewin set out to identify animals that might serve as a host for the coronavirus. The ancestor of the SARS-CoV-2 is thought to have emerged in a bat species native to China and may have infected another or more animal species before crossing over to humans. But as his research progressed, the data began to reveal that humans could be a vector, spreading the disease to wild animals. Lewin, distinguished professor of ecology and evolution at the University of California, Davis, says the potential for COVID-like disease outbreak in either captive or wild populations of endangered primates is pretty high. It's a particular concern for rare animals in captive settings, similar to the 8 infected lions and tigers at the Bronx Zoo in New York City. He says it's likely they picked up the virus from their human zookeepers. Infected humans could transmit the virus in parts of the world where wild animals come in close contact with people, such as parts of Africa. Professor Lewin cautioned, as the basis for their study, Lewin and his team looked more closely at the evolution and structure of the protein receptor ACE2, where the coronavirus attaches and subsequently enters human cells. They studied the protein across hundreds of vertebrate species, which allowed them to determine the relative risks of each to contracting the virus. The researchers examined the type and number of changes at 25 key positions of the ACE2 receptor and created a categorical ranking system ranging from very high to very low risk based on similarities and differences found at those spots. Animals with all 25 positions matching the human protein are thought to be most susceptible. Those predicted to be at very low risk, on the other hand, have ACE2 receptors that are quite different from that of humans. Among the 103 species that scored as very high or medium risk, 40% are classified as threatened under International Union of Conservation of nature's red list of threatened species, according to the study published recently in the Proceedings of the National Academy of the Sciences. The 18 very high-risk animals are all Old World primates and great apes. Yet some high-risk endangered species, like the baiji, a freshwater dolphin, Pierre David's deer, and a narrow-ridged, finless, porpoise whale, surprised the researchers because they're distantly related to humans. The researchers warned against overinterpreting their results, noting that true risk needs to be confirmed with experimental data, and the possibility that infection may occur through a cellular pathway other than ACE2 receptor cannot be ruled out, as there's more than one way the virus can penetrate the body, according to Professor Lewin. While several species are theoretically susceptible to catching the coronavirus, only a handful of captive animals, domestic dogs, domestic cats, lions, tigers, and minks, have so far been infected, notes Dallin Agnew, a professor in the Department of Pathobiology and Diagnostic Investigation at Michigan State University in the United States. In experimental settings, rhesus macaques, cynomolgus macaques, and African green monkeys caught the virus, but most demonstrated relatively mild clinical disease, according to a recent study. Similar studies have shown domestic ferrets have mild or undetectable signs of illness. Egyptian fruit bats show no symptoms at all, and Syrian hamsters experience mild to moderate disease. Even though the virus does not appear to be as lethal to animals as it is to humans, study co-author Klaus-Peter Kopfli, a research associate at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute, points out that mink can die as a result of contracting SARS-CoV-2. As it stands, he says, there simply isn't enough information available to fully understand why the virus can lead to increased mortality in some species compared to others. There's no evidence that the coronavirus is currently spreading to or within populations of wild animals. Still, some say we probably aren't aware of all infections similar to the way plenty of human cases have likely gone undetected throughout the pandemic. It is difficult to determine the extent to which the virus is actually spreading to animals, says Andrew Bowman, associate professor in the Department of Veterinary Preventative Medicine at Ohio State University. It's certainly something to keep an eye on, he says, especially vulnerable populations or those at the human-animal interface. Not only are our closest animal kin more susceptible due to genetics, like us, their highly social behavior also puts them in danger. Klaus-Peter Kopfli, a research associate at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute, notes one animal of concern is Africa's eastern gorilla, of which fewer than 5,000 remain. Divided into small populations and subspecies, including the well-known mountain gorilla. If these great apes, which live in close-knit family groups, become infected and die at similar rates to humans, he adds, it could further endanger the animals. Because of the ramifications, both Klaus-Peter Kopfli and Professor Lewin say precautionary measures are key. In settings such as national parks, staff should be regularly tested, because any contact could lead to the beginning of a pandemic in Old World primate species. It is also crucial that zoos continue to carry out their robust management plans to prevent spread of coronavirus from caretakers to animals. Professor Lewin says, maybe we were lucky that the virus spilled over into tigers, because if it had spilled over into primates, the result might have been quite different and possibly devastating to the old world primates in captivity at the Bronx Zoo in New York.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kHz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In our previous program, we mentioned one of the results of remaining in the state of purity or being in wudu majority of the time or most of the time. Best time to actually do this when you're actually going out to do something. You know, you're in the wudu. It also has a lot of other benefits to it. For example, just quickly mentioning, if you go out to, for example, a shopping mall or, you know, wherever you are going, and it's time for salah, you can just quickly, you know, you have wudu, you pray your salah quickly. This is one of the advantages. However, in the tradition we will mention today, it's a very, again, simple step that a person can take in order for a person's lifespan to be increased by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The previous one was about wudu, something simple, something that takes less than 5 minutes to do. And this one, it's something that requires no effort whatsoever. you could say, okay, in the previous one, you had to get water. You had to go and stand on one leg at times, depending on where you're making the wudu, and so on and so forth. But in this one, you don't require anything. You just require yourself, the most self-evident thing that you have, your own being, yourself, and your thoughts. And by doing this particular action within yourself, inshallah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if done with the proper intention, again, be very careful to this word, or with the proper purpose rather, as opposed to you saying it, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inshallah, will increase your lifespan. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is reported to have said that person who has good intentions, just good intentions, he wants to do good things, he wants to, help others, for example. He doesn't do it, he wants to. He wants to, for example, give charity. He wants to, for example, provide for his family, and so on and so forth. And sometimes you have an individual who doesn't have the ability to do so, but he wants to do it. He really has the urge and the fervor to do it, but he just doesn't have the ability to, or the capability to. That's different from someone who has the capability and doesn't want to, but intends to. You need to keep this in mind in the context of this tradition. So the Imam says that he who has good intentions is given increase in lifespan. Again, as we mentioned in our previous program, the concept of lifespan, the concept of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's qadr and qadr, or divine decree and predestination, and so on and so forth, the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, all this comes into play in this hadith. And we said, because the theological basis of the school of thought of the followers, or rather the theological school of thought of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, has the ability to answer these questions very succinctly, very properly, that we have no qualms in this. But some individuals who follow other theological schools of thought might find difficulty in answering this based on what I mentioned previously. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, first of all, to give us those good intentions that are proper, and then obviously to give us the reward of that, or the blessing of that, and then to use that increase in worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant.